It is the spring of 1933, a few weeks after Hitler has taken power in Germany. In Frankfurt, a 23-year-old newspaper editor from Vienna publishes a small book praising a conservative philosopher who was born Jewish. He knows exactly what will happen. The new government bans it and burns it, and the young man packs up and leaves the country, first for London, then for America, where he will more or less invent the field of management. Today, The Effective Executive by Peter Drucker, published in 1967. In two sentences, effectiveness is not a talent, it is a set of practices that can be learned, and there are five of them. Know where your time goes, focus on outward contribution, build on strength, do first things first, and make decisions as judgments tested by disagreement. This is also the episode where the show changes shape a little. The neurodiversity thread runs through the whole walkthrough now, not saved for the end. You will hear why this book, of all of them, earns that. From the Reading Room, this is 60 Books. I'm Miles. One management book per episode, the kind of chief executive might quote at you, taken apart in about 20 minutes. Today's book is the oldest one we will cover, and the reason it comes third is that the first two books we did are, quietly, rewrites of it. Jim Collins' Right People on the Bus, James Clear's Systems Over Willpower. Both of those roads lead back to a Viennese man with a typewriter. Nora, the cold open, was the author this time.
It had to be. Drucker's life is the best story in the book.
Pick it up in Vienna.
Peter Drucker is born in Vienna in 1909. His father is a senior civil servant, and the family living room is a salon. Economists, lawyers, scientists coming through the house every week, arguing. The boy grows up assuming that ideas are things adults fight about over dinner. And there is a moment he told for the rest of his life. A teacher, when Drucker is about 13, asks the class what they want to be remembered for. Nobody can answer. And the teacher says, "I did not expect you to. But if you cannot answer it by 50, you will have wasted your life." Drucker said he asked himself that question every year until he died.
How does he get to Germany?
He leaves Vienna young, works in Hamburg, then lands in Frankfurt, where he becomes a senior editor at a major daily paper while he is still in his early 20s, and picks up a doctorate in international law on the side in 1931. Then comes the book From the Cold Open. He published it, he later said, as a deliberate affront to the Nazis, so there could be no mistaking where he stood. It was banned and burned. He left for London, worked in a bank, married Doris, and sailed for America in 1937.
And the management career starts where?
With an invitation that changed the field. In 1943, General Motors, then the largest corporation on Earth, invited him inside to study how it actually worked. 2 years of sitting in meetings and walking factory floors became concept of the corporation in 1946, essentially the first serious book to treat a company as a human organization worth studying. The punchline is that GM hated it. Drucker had suggested the divine right of managers was not a management principle. He kept going anyway. The practice of management in 54. In 1959, he coins the term knowledge worker, a phrase we now live inside. 39 books in total, a professorship at NYU, then Claremont in California, which eventually named its management school after him. He consulted for corporations, but also for the Girl Scouts and the Salvation Army, which he considered as well-run as anything in the Fortune 500. Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2002. He died in 2005, 8 days short of 96.
And this book of the 39.
1967. It is short, it is blunt, and it makes one radical claim in the first chapter. There is no such thing as an effective personality. He says he has met effective executives who were charismatic and effective executives who were nearly invisible, warm ones, cold ones, quick ones, slow ones. What they shared was not a temperament. It was a set of practices, and practices can be learned. Effectiveness, he says, is a habit.
Which is James Clear's entire book, 60 years early.
Clear would agree. So let us do the five practices, and as promised, the neurodivergent thread runs through each one as we go.
Practice 1.
Know thy time. Drucker says effective executives do not start with their tasks. They start with their time, and they do not start by planning it. They start by recording it because memory lies. His anecdote: a company chairman who was completely certain his time went one-third to senior colleagues, one-third to important customers, one-third to the community. They logged 6 weeks. It turned out he spent most of his time as a kind of dispatcher, chasing orders for customers he happened to know personally and interrupting the plan about them. The log had to be shown to him repeatedly before he believed it.
So record, then prune, then consolidate.
Three steps. Record where it goes. Cut what serves nothing, and he is savage here. His line on meetings is that a meeting is by definition a concession to deficient organization. You meet because the knowledge needed for the work is scattered across heads. And third, consolidate what remains into large blocks, because knowledge work in 15-minute fragments is not work at all.
Here is where the thread starts, because this chapter assumes you can feel where your time goes.
And that assumption fails in a specific, well-documented way. In the ADHD literature, Russell Barkley's 1997 theory in Psychological Bulletin tied the condition to behavioral inhibition and a set of executive functions, working memory, self-regulation, the internal management of behavior across time. One downstream effect is what clinicians informally call time blindness. The felt sense of time passing and of how long things take is unreliable. Now listen to what Drucker prescribes. Do not trust the feeling. Record it. Externalize it. Let the log tell you the truth. That is not just compatible with an ADHD profile. It is the accommodation, written in 1967 for everybody.
The same move as last episode. Move it out of the head and into the environment.
Same move applied to time instead of habits, and one more turn for autistic professionals. A calendar full of meetings is not a neutral cost. Each meeting spends social and sensory budget as well as minutes, and the price is invisible on the schedule. Drucker's meeting rule gives a leader clean, non-clinical language for cutting them. Nobody has to disclose anything. The chairman just says what Drucker said. Too many meetings means the organization is built wrong.
Practice 2.
What can I contribute? Drucker says the ineffective executive looks down and in, my efforts, my department, my authority. The effective one looks up and out. What result, outside my own work, am I actually responsible for? He wants the question asked literally. Walk into the role and ask, what can I contribute that would significantly affect the results of this institution?
And the thread here.
Contribution is an outcome standard, and outcome standards are the fairest ground neurodivergent professionals ever stand on. The alternative, and it is the default in most offices, is a style standard. Eye contact, meeting presence, hallway warmth, seeming engaged. There is a growing research literature on autistic camouflaging, the daily performance of expected social style, and it consistently links that performance to exhaustion and burnout. A leader who takes Drucker seriously and judges on contribution has, without using a single clinical word, removed the tax. So when a chief executive quotes this chapter, the question to hand them is simple. Does your review process measure contribution, or does it measure performance of engagement?
Practice 3, this is the one.
Make strengths productive. Drucker says the effective executive staffs for what a person can do, not for the absence of weaknesses. His line is that strong people always have strong weaknesses, and that whoever tries to place people to avoid weakness ends up with mediocrity. He wants the question flipped from what can this person not do, to what can this person do uncommonly well, and then he wants the job built so the weakness is simply irrelevant.
There is a Lincoln story here.
Famous one. Lincoln is told that General Grant drinks too much whiskey, and he supposedly answers, "Find out his brand, I will send a barrel to my other generals." I will flag now that historians consider that story almost certainly apocryphal. It echoes a much older anecdote about a British king, and we will come back to it in the critique. But Drucker's use of it is clear. Lincoln needed a general who won battles, and he staffed for the strength.
See the quiet part.
This chapter is the neurodiversity thesis, published when the word did not exist. The modern case, the one made in the Harvard Business Review in 2017 under the title Neurodiversity as a Competitive Advantage, is that neurodivergent profiles are often spiky, exceptional at some things, genuinely poor at others, and that hiring systems built to screen out weakness screen out the spike along with it. That is Drucker's argument 60 years early with one addition he would have liked. The monotropism theory in the autism literature, from Dinah Murray and colleagues in 2005, describes attention that concentrates into few interests at unusual depth. Staff for that strength, engineer around the rest, and you get what Drucker promised. Performance mediocre teams cannot reach. Fail to, and you get what he warned about.
And it connects backward.
Straight to episode 1. Collins's Right People in the Right Seats is this chapter, with a bus metaphor on top. The seat shaped to the person is Drucker's job built, so the weakness does not matter.
Practice 4.
First things first. Drucker's word for it is concentration. Effective executives do one thing at a time, and it is the important thing, not the urgent one. Two ideas carry the chapter. The first is sloughing off yesterday, Before starting anything new, ask of every existing activity, if we were not already doing this, would we start it now? If the answer is no, stop. The second is his best coinage in the book, posteriorities. Everyone sets priorities. The hard, dangerous, career-threatening act is setting posteriorities, deciding out loud what will not be done. He says priorities are easy because they please people. Posteriorities make enemies.
The stop doing list,
which we met in episode 1, and the environment pruning we met in episode 2. Both are Drucker's posteriorities wearing newer clothes. Now the thread, and this chapter cuts in two directions. For an ADHD profile, one thing at a time is the right prescription and the hardest one, because the pull is toward the novel and the urgent. So the practice cannot live as an intention. It has to live in the environment, a visible, externalized short list, with everything else formally posterioritized so it stops calling. But there is a strength side too. The hyperfocus literature, and there is a proper research review on this from 2019 called Hyperfocus, The Forgotten Frontier of Attention, describes exactly the deep, sustained absorption Drucker is asking for, occurring naturally in ADHD and autistic cognition when interest and task align. Which means the leader's job is not to teach concentration. It is to aim it, using practice 3, and to protect it, using practice 1. The large, consolidated time blocks Drucker wants are the native habitat of a monotropic or hyperfocusing mind. The fragmented calendar is its destruction.
Practice 5.
Effective decisions. Two chapters and the most quoted material in the book. Drucker says a decision is a judgment, not a fact-finding mission. You start with opinions, because that is what people actually have, and then you insist each opinion be tested against reality. What will we have to see for this to be true? You define the boundary conditions, the minimum the decision must accomplish. You convert the decision into someone's assigned action with a deadline. And you build in feedback, because decisions are made by people, and people are fallible.
And the disagreement rule.
The Alfred Sloan story. At a General Motors committee meeting, Sloan looks around and observes that everyone is in complete agreement on the decision. Then, instead of approving it, he proposes postponing the matter to the next meeting to give everyone time to develop some disagreement, because until there is disagreement, he says, nobody has understood the question. Drucker generalizes it into a rule: do not decide without dissent.
The thread writes itself here.
It is episode 1's brutal facts, with a mechanism attached. An organization that follows Sloan's rule has made the blunt, accurate, socially unpolished dissenter into a structural requirement rather than a tolerated irritant. Autistic directness stops being a liability the moment disagreement is a formal input to deciding. And one more practical note for the neurodivergent executive themselves. Drucker's insistence on boundary conditions, written down before the debate, is a guard against both the ADHD failure mode of deciding in the enthusiasm of the moment and the anxious failure mode of redeciding forever. The conditions are external. The decision either meets them or it does not.
What has not held up?
Start with the evidence base, because there is not one. The book is one consultant's distilled observation. No data, no comparison group, no methodology beyond a brilliant man watching organizations for 30 years. Every claim in it is an aphorism, and aphorisms do not replicate, they persuade. Second, the anecdotes. The Lincoln whiskey story is, as promised, almost certainly a 19th century newspaper invention, recycled from an older story about King George II, and Drucker, a trained historian of ideas, probably knew it and used it anyway because it teaches. Third, the book is entirely of 1967 in one visible way. The executive is he, on every page, without exception. And fourth, his meeting rule collides with the reality of modern collaborative work, a rule written when knowledge workers were rare reads differently when they are the whole company.
And the other side of the ledger
is remarkable. Knowledge worker, coined in 1959, turned out to be the story of the next 70 years of the economy. The time use finding, that people's self-reports are badly wrong until confronted with a record, has been reproduced in workplace research over and over. And the influence question is not even close. The books that CEOs actually read today are this book, Refracted. So the tier, practitioner literature, the founding document of the shelf, unverified by design, and more right than it had any right to be.
The recap in the frame this show exists for. The effective executive says effectiveness is learnable practices, not personality. For a neurodivergent leader, or a leader of neurodivergent people, Every one of the five practices lands as an accommodation written for everyone. The time log because the felt sense of time lies, contribution because style standards tax difference, strengths because spiky profiles are the point, posteriorities because focus must be defended in the environment, and structured dissent because the organization needs its blunt truth tellers on purpose. Drucker built the accessible workplace by accident, 60 years early, and called it effectiveness. Which leaves the machines.
Here Drucker is waiting for us again, because in 1967 he wrote about the computer, in this book, and in an essay whose title I will paraphrase gently. He called the computer a fast and obedient moron. His point was not contempt. It was that the machine handles the inside, the quantifiable, the past, and that precisely because it does, the executive is freed and forced to do the human work, the outside, the unquantifiable, the future.
Run the five practices through today's tools.
Practice one is the cleanest fit in the whole series. Know thy time no longer requires 6 weeks of manual logging. Calendar analytics and automatic time tracking produce Drucker's record with no working memory required, which for an ADHD executive removes the exact step most likely to fail. Meeting transcription and summaries give back the sensory and social budget we talked about. For contribution, a weekly AI-generated summary of outcomes, what moved, not what was attended, keeps the review conversation on Drucker's standard. For strengths, drafting support and tone checking let the spiky profile ship its spike while the machine patches the gap, the way a calculator patched arithmetic. And for decisions, a model makes a cheap, tireless loan. Ask it to argue against the room before the room agrees.
Cautions.
The usual two, plus Drucker's own. The evidence that these tools improve outcomes for neurodivergent workers is early, practitioner reports and small studies, promising practice, not established. Tool churn is the doom loop from episode 1 and motion from episode 2. The tool only counts if the practice runs through it on a bad day. And the 1967 warning still holds the deepest. If the machine now handles the inside, then the hours it returns to you are owed to the outside, to customers, to the world, to the future. An executive who spends the freed time supervising the machine has bought a faster moron and become its assistant.
Nora, thank you.
Thank you.
That is the effective executive. Next time on 60 Books, Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell, the book that told a generation of executives that 10,000 hours makes anyone an expert, and what the research actually found when it checked. I'm Miles. See you then.